This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where we remind you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done things you might not even be able to imagine for the sake of our freedom. Each week we visit with veterans. We want them to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice. We don't want to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, so we want to preserve their stories and along the way be educated and inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today is going to turn 90 this May, but he was a lot younger than that when he got involved in World War II. We'll go back to the early days because you had a pretty big family growing up. Al Metzger, our guest today, you are one of 10 children? 10 children.
10 and the youngest. Seven girls and three boys.
So you had a lot of people to look out for you. I bet you were protected as a kid.
I was the baby of the family, and they all took care of me, especially my sisters. They always took care of me. I was their baby.
And you grew up in Fresno?
Went to Edison.
What was Fresno like in the 1930s when you were a kid growing up?
I remember the streetcars. I remember that. And I remember Fulton Street. That was the street we all dragged on every Saturday night. I remember all that.
Yeah, and Fulton Street's got to make a comeback now in Fresno after being a pedestrian mall for all these years. And I guess somewhere along the way when you were in high school is when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember when that happened and how you found out about it? On December 7th, 41, did they call you into the gym and make you listen to President Roosevelt, or did you read about it in the paper? Or?
I must have read about it or heard about it on the news, but that's about what I remember about it.
So the war's going on when you graduate from high school and you decided you wanted to go build ships. How did that come around?
That's right. I took off for San Francisco and worked in the shipyards for about a year building Liberty ships. Then I got tired of that and I came home. And about 2 months later, I was in the Army. That's what happened to me.
Yeah, and he would end up with a Distinguished Flying Cross after 30 missions in B-24s in Europe. We're going to talk about that. But I want to talk about this experience at the shipyards real quick. We actually had a program a few months back from Pier 45 in San Francisco where you can climb aboard a World War II submarine and also a World War II Liberty ship like the ones that you were working on. It's the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. A crew of volunteers keeps it going. They'll even fire up the steam boiler and take it out into San Francisco Bay. It's pretty remarkable, an incredible piece of history. If you want to go back and listen to that, you can find it in the archives at hometownheroesradio.com. But one of the things I remember about the tour of the Jeremiah O'Brien there is the plaque that speaks to how many of those ships were produced in such a short time period. Over 2,700 Liberty ships, I believe. It was quite the operation, and if you haven't visited the Jeremiah O'Brien before, I'd say put that on your list for your next trip to San Francisco. But I want to know about 70-plus years ago in San Francisco. Was that something you guys were conscious of, that there was some urgency to get those ships out?
Yeah, we had to get them out because we had to get them troops on there to go over, and we built them pretty fast. That's about what I remember. I was on a night shift. I worked from 12 to morning, and I was by myself, lived in a little room up there, and that was about it.
Was there a specific part of the ships that you were responsible for putting together?
We built the platforms where they gonna put the ships on, so I was like a carpenter working on the timbers. That was my job down there.
So what, that was too boring for you? It wasn't enough excitement? You wanted to get overseas, or was it because your brother was already overseas, or what?
That's right. My brother was over, and I just got tired of it and wanted to do my duty, so I came home, and that's why I went into service.
Now, obviously, I wasn't alive back then, but working in a defense-related industry there, producing ships in the shipyard, would you have had an exemption from going into the service?
Yes, sir. We couldn't even leave there. We were, that was it. You couldn't leave. If you left, you knew you was going to get drafted or whatever, so that didn't bother me. I just got tired of it, and I just went into the service, and that's what I wanted to do.
And what was it that drew you to the Army Air Corps? Were you thinking you might become a pilot?
No, I really wanted to get in the paratroopers. what happened was I was going through armor school, and my dad passed away. So I came home, and then when I went back, the group I was with was way ahead of me. So I didn't want to start with a new group, so I volunteered to get into paratroopers. But they said, you had too much experience now in this class. You got to stay in and go through it. So that's when I finished that.
Well, and you know, you mentioned that, and I think about a big family with 10 children, and your father passes away with one of your brothers overseas. That had to be a pretty significant ordeal. Was that difficult for you to deal with that and to come to grips with at that young age?
Sure. When the last day I remember at home before I went into service, we lived about 4 blocks from the train station. And my dad walked me down that day to get on the train to go into the service. And I never seen him again. He passed away. That's it.
Well, and I know it's not easy to talk about that or some of the other things we're going to deal with. And that had to be hard. Now, you've already signed up, and your brother's overseas. I'm sure you were concerned for your mother and your sisters, huh?
That's why my middle brother stayed home, didn't go into service to take care of my mother. That's why he never went into service.
But you did, and you end up in the Army Air Corps. You ended up with the 389th Bomb Group, 30 missions you survived as a gunner. Do you remember the first time you looked at a B-24 and what your impressions of that awkward-looking airplane were?
Yeah, because I couldn't understand why we had two tails in the back there. And it looked real bulky compared to a B-17. They were slim, but it just was a big, bulky airplane, but you had to go where they told you and what plane you got on. So that's why I ended up with the B-24 group.
Was it exciting for you to get up in the air with one of those and all the other guys on your crew?
Why, sure. When I went to gunnery school back in Florida, and the first plane I flew on was, they had a pilot with a seat in the front, and they put you in the front of the seat. They'd fly over the swamps, and you had a 30 machine gun, and you fired, and they'd put some kind of malfunction in it, and you had to find that. So when I fired and mine stopped, you had a certain stuff you looked for. When I found mine, Dad put a short round in it, and I jammed it. I went into somewhere where they picked you out for groups. They put me on a group with 24s. That's why I was on 24s.
And you actually flew all 30 of those missions with the same crew?
With the same crew. Mm-hmm. The name of our plane was Sweet Pea. Sweet Pea 1 was shot down, and then we got Sweet Pea 2. That was the name of our plane, Sweet Pea 2.
I want to get this story because I'm trying to imagine myself, and I've got a picture here. Folks can find it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page of you as a baby-faced Army Air Corps serviceman. And I'm thinking of a kid that age dealing with the things that you're dealing with. When you were heading overseas, you haven't flown one mission yet. You have no idea what this is going to be like. Can you remember what that felt like or what you might have been thinking at that tender age?
All I knew or I thought was, to tell you the truth, I prayed a lot that I'd be getting home.
You went into the service in February of 1943 at the age of 18, and then just after your 20th birthday in May of 44, you were heading overseas. And when you think about all the millions of Americans who were serving overseas, it's pretty hard to believe that when you got to your base in England, you ran into a familiar face. Tell us who you ran into over there, half a world away from Central California, in Hethel, England, where you were based with that 389th Bomb Group.
When I got over there and I got on this base, I found out my brother was at the same base. So that was a surprise. It wasn't too good for him because every time we went out in the Carmack to go on a flight, he'd be worried over there. So anyway, it was good I had my brother there to back me up. He was my older brother, and it was just good I had him over there.
Yeah, one more person praying for you certainly isn't going to hurt. You got there just a little more than a week before the D-Day invasion, and I know you flew before that. So what do you remember about that first mission you had as a gunner on a B-24?
I don't know how it felt. It just, all I know is you're scared. I know that. If they say they're not, they're lying because you are scared. And the first mission, I don't even know where we went, but all I know is you're scared and you pray a lot. That's about it.
And I know eventually you manned a few different spots on B-24s, but what position were you in on that first mission?
I was a waist gunner.
And that would seem to me, especially if this is your first mission, you talk about on edge. You're standing there looking out that little hole and hoping that nothing shows up for you to shoot at, I guess, huh?
Yeah, we at the waist, you had one 50 caliber machine gun. I didn't have a bubble on. We didn't have a bubble on our waist. It was wide open. So you can just look at everything. Well, it just scared you. That was about it.
Let me ask you this. If you flew with the same crew all those missions, how did you feel about your pilot? I imagine you got to know your pilot pretty well.
Yeah, he was an older fella, and the co-pilot was only 21, a young man himself, and he always took care of us. That was the main thing. He always made sure we got the best whatever we could get.
So you had a lot of trust in him, it sounds like.
We sure did. We believed in him. He was a good pilot.
Maybe you can walk us through, because most people listening have never been on a B-24, certainly not in combat during World War II. Walk us through what that's like and some of the different positions on the plane that you experienced, maybe what the challenges of those positions were, what it took to be successful in those spots. What do you remember about being aboard those big planes?
Well, I know we had a tail gunner sat way in the back, and then you came forward from there, and there was a waist gunner, one on each side. And then up there in the front was a nose gunner. And then up on top was our engineer, had the top gun. And then we had the radio man that sat in behind the pilot and the co-pilot. Behind the nose gunner was the bombardier and the navigator. And right from the waist gunners there was a bulkhead. And that's when we took off or we landed. We always, in the back, the tail gunner and us two waist gunners, always sat up against that bulkhead, thinking if you crash, you at least had a chance, you know. But that's about what it was in there.
What was it like when you were in that nose gun? Is that a different perspective when you're not looking out the side of the plane, but you can actually see what's in front of you and down below?
If I remember, the reason I was in that nose gunner, our nose gunner guy left or something, and they put me in there for a couple of missions. And I didn't like that because he was right in the front, and you seen everything coming and going. And I didn't like that. And when they got the regular nose gunner, then they moved me to the waist. And I felt a lot better back there. I didn't see what was coming in front.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I wouldn't want to see it either. You mentioned that you did a lot of praying. So I know there were a lot of moments that made you wonder if those prayers or some divine intervention would be needed. Did you fly on D-Day? Were you part of that giant armada in the sky?
Yes. D-Day, yeah.
What do you remember about that day and what led up to it? Did they get you up in the middle of the night?
We always got up around midnight or 1 o'clock. We did that on every mission and go down and eat, and then you go to a briefing room and they tell you your targets or where they think you're going to get plaque, and then you might get hit with fighters. So that same day, D-Day was just like any other day to me. We did the same thing.
I've talked to a lot of guys, well, people on every corner of D-Day, whether they're on one of those ships or they were up in the sky, guys just kind of marvel at the magnitude of it. How many planes? How many ships? What did you see that day? What did it look like?
Well, it was just nothing but the sky was full of planes, and when you look down, nothing but ships all around. That's what I remember.
And you didn't have to worry about being the one dropping the bombs or anything. You just had to make sure if any enemy aircraft came your way, you'd be ready?
That's right. You always waited and watched for that.
How often in 30 missions did you guys have to deal with flak from the ground?
I think almost every one. We always got some flak somewhere. I remember, I don't know where we were going that day. I don't know if we were going to Berlin that day or where, but I remember that flak come up so thick, it was like a black cloud there, then you could get out and walk on it. That's how thick it was.
And that's got to be a bit of a helpless feeling because you know the pilot has to stay in formation, right?
The bombardier would take you through the target. And once you start for the target, the plane didn't. It just went. You couldn't maneuver or nothing. And then when them flak come up like that, it just scared you.
So what do you do? I mean, do you try to hide in the corner?
No, you don't. You got to watch so you're not going to be hit with something else, with a fighter or something like that. As a rule, when you go through the target, the fighters didn't come up because all that anti-aircraft was coming up.
Well, that makes sense. Tell you what, let's hold there for a minute. We need to catch a break. I have a feeling that all that flack led to a few holes in that big B-24, and I'm curious to find out how close some of those calls were for Albert Metzger. He's going to turn 90 years old this May. You can see his smiling face as a teenage airman on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear more of his World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Los Banos. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Los Banos is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Los Banos, California.